Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Whatever the perception of Bitcoin in the wake of these cases, what's important to remember is that Bitcoin itself was never hacked or compromised. Welcome, everyone, to the Coin Bureau podcast. My name is Guy, and I'm here with my very good friend,
Mad Mike Mooch.
Welcome back, Mike.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So I just want to update listeners slightly. The last couple of episodes that we did on Bitcoin, this is our third episode on Bitcoin that we're doing today. We've looked back at some of the people who helped make Bitcoin what it was, some of the things they had in common, and basically Bitcoin's early days, from Satoshi putting it out there and the slow growth of the network, slowly people getting to know about it, improving it, all this sort of stuff. It's now time to look at Bitcoin out in the wild. And in this episode, we're going to focus on two of the most notorious projects that have ever been associated with Bitcoin.
Yes.
Okay. We are going to look at Mt. Gox and the Silk Road.
I know about one of them.
You do? Okay. I think I know which one.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. So, yes. So these are two projects that still cast a pretty long shadow over Bitcoin, I think. But before we start talking about them, let's just quickly consider, how do I get my hands on some Bitcoins? Let's put ourselves back, and this time sort of around 2011 or so it was. Yeah, 2011, mid-2011. Today, if we want to get our hands on some BTC or any other cryptocurrency, it's easy, isn't it?
Fairly easy, yeah.
Yeah, we've got the likes of, there are hundreds of exchanges, things like Coinbase, Binance, all these sorts of things. Coinbase especially, very user-friendly. It's pretty easy for the average person to get their hands on some crypto. We've also got things like Bitcoin ATMs. You can actually go and buy it on the street.
Are they still about?
Yeah.
Because I remember there was, in London, there was a couple down by Old Street where you'd literally feed in cash and then
You can still do that. There don't seem to be quite as many as there were.
Is that not a money laundering sort of issue? Or?
I don't think so, but there have been concerns raised about that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I suppose, yeah, it would be one way if you had a large amount of cash and you wanted to get rid of it and convert it, then yeah, a Bitcoin ATM would be quite useful for that. I think a lot of them now, you have to provide ID before you
That's
use
probably
them.
I don't think you did before.
Yeah.
It was quite simply just feeding in notes and
making cash basically digital. There are Bitcoin ATMs still. I think worldwide the number is growing, but here in London, you've also got peer-to-peer Bitcoin services as well, things like Local Bitcoins, where you can go on the site, find someone in your area who is willing to sell you Bitcoins, and you can actually go and meet up with them, and you give them some cash, and they will transfer some Bitcoin
safe.
To your wallet. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong with that?
Meet me here with some cash.
It can be a little dodgy. You have to be very careful with things like Local Bitcoins, but it does still work, and it's quite popular in certain parts of the world, I think.
I can imagine,
where there's less infrastructure.
Maybe where it's not legal.
Yeah.
Philippines.
Yeah. Or
is it not legal in the Philippines, am I thinking of Indonesia?
I'm not sure. I mean, these places are sort of, they're always kind of talking about whether they're going to ban crypto or crypto payments. Turkey is one that Turkey recently banned crypto payments. And I think in Turkey, Local Bitcoins is quite popular, if I remember rightly. So, in short, it's easy now to get your hands on crypto, but back in the early days of Bitcoin, it wasn't always so. So if you weren't a particularly techie person, for example, then your options were limited because these techie people knew how to mine on their laptops, whereas the average person really didn't. It's quite a complicated process for those unfamiliar. And of course, most people hadn't even heard of Bitcoin anyway. There were very few ways that you could actually get your hands on some BTC. You could visit Gavin Andreessen's Bitcoin Faucet. Do you remember that from the last episode? That was probably the easiest way of doing it. Fill out the capture. 5 free BTC. Thank you very much. You might also remember from the last episode, Marty Malmy, the Finnish chap, became the first person to receive US dollars in exchange for BTC. And he sent a Bitcoin forum user called New Liberty Standard. He sent him just over 5,000 BTC and received $5.02 back via PayPal. Now, what New Liberty Standard was trying to do, he was trying to set up a site where people could actually buy Bitcoins rather than having to mine them. Basically, the first ever exchange. And that's exactly what this user did. And the exchange was called New Liberty Standard. And you sent money via PayPal. And a little later on, BTC would turn up in your wallet. So, yeah, this was a big moment because it enabled people to buy BTC for
buy into
the first
the
time.
Project.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting the way that whoever ran New Liberty Standard, the way they calculated the price of Bitcoins, you paid roughly what it cost to mine each coin. So the way New Liberty Standard did this was they basically calculated it from their electricity bill and came up with a very rough figure of how much each Bitcoin cost to mine. And I think I've got it here. I think the price was calculated at about 0.00764 cents back in October 2009, meaning you could buy over 1,300 Bitcoin for a dollar.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's not dwell on that. New Liberty Standard itself, it didn't last long. It shut down shortly after opening. And this coincided with the fact that in late 2009, early 2010, Bitcoin had kind of stalled a bit. It had run out of steam. It wasn't the network, the sort of adoption, the excitement that had gradually built up after its launch had kind of plateaued out a bit. So nothing in particular was really happening. So, yeah, New Liberty Standard, I don't think it became really worth their while to do it because no one was that interested in buying Bitcoins. What this did do, though, was leave a gap in the market for these non-techie people to be able to pick up Bitcoins. And again, Marty, he ran an exchange, but it was slow and it was basically a real faff, I think. It was quite... He had other things going on.
Yeah.
And as we'll see, running a Bitcoin exchange is a stressful job, stressful and time consuming. And a couple of weeks ago, I had a chat with a couple of friends of mine. I'm not going to reveal their identities, so we'll just call them Alice and Bob. And they were talking, they were in Bitcoin around this time. They were really early adopters. And we were talking about this kind of period. And they said that one of the only ways that you could get your hands on Bitcoins was via basically peer-to-peer transactions. And you set these up over internet relay chat, which was, you know, a text-based chat system. It's I think it's still around, but it's not really used these days. I mean, obviously things like WhatsApp and Telegram have kind of taken over. But yeah, basically an internet-based chat system. And you would work out a deal with another internet relay chat user. And you basically had to trust them. So yeah, I'd be talking to you over IRC, and I go, okay, I've got some bitcoins for sale. Do you want them? We'd agree a price, and then one or the other would have to make the first move. So I would either have to send you the bitcoins, or you'd send me the dollars,
or send a little bit. I'll send a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, you could have done it like that. But basically, there was trust involved. And as we've seen, Bitcoin was designed to be trustless. So there was this kind of hole in the whole system, in that you basically had to trust someone that you'd met on the internet, which is not ideal. Mind you,
take a seat.
mind you, talking to Alice and Bob, they said that generally they didn't really have any problems with that. And again, I think this is probably...
I think when it's worth a dollar.
Yeah.
It's not, people are not really looking to swindle you out of $5.
Yeah, I don't think there were huge amounts of money changing hands. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's why go to the effort of swindling someone out of a few bucks? Yeah. They said that it generally went fine. It wasn't really a problem. And I think this is partly because the community itself was still quite small. I think it's one of these things, it's a community of believers. And they're much more likely to be straight with each other. It's only when these things get bigger that the kind of bad actors come into play.
Yeah.
So there was a gap in the market for people wanting to get their hands on bitcoins. So this is when a chap called Jed McCaleb turns up. Now, Jed McCaleb is a really interesting chap. Do you remember last time I mentioned that there was a post on the sort of geek website Slashdot?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was in July 2010. And that got a lot of interest in Bitcoin going. A lot of people read that post, heard about Bitcoin for the first time, and started digging into it. And one of these people was Jed McCaleb, who was, believe it or not, a software developer. One of them again, a programmer. He was originally from Arkansas. Funnily enough, though, Jed McCaleb is really not...
Is it
not
Jed or Jeb?
Jed.
Jed, J-E-D.
J-E-D, yeah. Funnily enough, he's not really your typical computer geek. He's got a very sort of...
Oh, really?
I'll believe that when I see it. He's actually got a very laid-back sort of surfer dude vibe. So Jed had dabbled in quite a few projects. He dropped out of college and he'd sort of tinkered around various things. One of his first successes was a file sharing program that was kind of similar to Napster. It took its inspiration from Napster. It was called eDonkey.
I do remember that.
Do you?
I do remember eDonkey for some... I don't know.
Yeah. I don't, but I remember because you sort of... You're more... attuned with that word. I wanted to ask you about that, whether you remember eDonkey.
That sort of definitely rings a bell.
Yeah. So it was, yeah, eDonkey was quite successful. And it made Jed a fair bit of money. Unfortunately, you won't be surprised to hear that kind of attracted the attention of the powers that be. The Recording Industry Association of America basically sued him and his partner who he'd set it up with and forced them to shut it down, which is probably the least surprising bit of news you'll ever hear.
Mm.
So he did have form with kind of finding a gap in the market, developing technology to exploit it. But while the likes of Hal Finney, you remember him, Marty, Laszlo and Gavin, all guys from last episode. Now, these guys that we talked about before, they were really tech focused. And obviously, Jed, being a software developer, he had a kind of tech focus as well. But he was more entrepreneurial. that's where his that was kind of more the direction that he leaned in. And this is, I think, really important, because up until now, we've had these guys who are just focused on improving Bitcoin, just on working on the project. And then Jed McCaleb comes along, and I'm not saying this I'm not saying this as a negative. But I think his interest was definitely more of like, how can I not just contribute to the project, but how can I exploit it? How can I benefit? Yeah, benefit is a better word than exploit, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think he was purely out to make money, but he certainly succeeded in doing that. So another project that he'd started, and as we're going to see, Jed is a kind of... He flits from project to project. He's got quite a few. He's got quite a few scalps, if you like.
Mm.
So something else that he'd started, kind of half started, if you like, was a site where players of a game called Magic: The Gathering could trade cards used in the game. Okay. Now, have you heard of Magic: The Gathering?
Yes. It's basically kind of a Dungeons and Dragons sort of. Mm. Very software developer sort of
the kind of thing software developers do.
Maybe not your Arkansas surfer dude software developer. Maybe your traditional.
Yeah, well, he was obviously. I think he must have been
Magic
a fan.
The Gathering.
Magic: The Gathering. Yeah, it's fantasy role play.
Yeah,
which really when I read that, I was like, that's all I need to know.
Yeah.
I don't need to dig into that. That's not really for me. But obviously, it's
very popular.
Still very popular, I think. Yeah, so Jed had put together this website where you could trade Magic: The Gathering cards online. And he basically lost interest, from what I can see. So he shut it down after just a few months. But he kept it dormant. He kept hold of the domain name and all that sort of stuff. And so when he saw the Slashdot post, he really loved the sound of Bitcoin, and he tried to buy some, but he found, as we've seen, that it was quite difficult to do so. So he had the idea, hey, I'm an entrepreneurial guy. I've got some software skills. I've got some coding skills. I'm going to create an exchange where you can do it. He spotted the gap in the market and went to fill it. And he basically, from what I've read, he basically sort of got this exchange up and running. He built it, if you like, pretty much overnight. So he locked himself away in his study and built this thing overnight. And he needed a domain name. And he remembered that he had this kind of dormant domain for Magic: The Gathering cards. So he just thought, oh, I'll use that. Waste not, want not. So the domain name was mtgox.com, okay, and that stood for Magic: The Gathering Online Exchange. So he stuck with that, and that has since come to be known as Mt. Gox. Now, apparently, you're supposed to pronounce it Mt. Gox, but no one ever does.
No,
it's been Mt. Gox, forever.
Is there a word for that when things just become pronounced in the way that, you know?
Probably, but I've no idea what it is. That can be your job. You can get on Google and find that out. In the meantime, so Mt. Gox, that's where this rather strange name came from. And it worked like this. Basically, customers signed up for an account with Mt. Gox and they deposited money straight into Jed's PayPal account.
Yes.
He then held this money on their behalf. They were able to trade on the exchange using the funds that he was holding for them. And the way the exchange made its money, obviously, was to take a small percentage cut of each transaction. And it quickly became really popular because interest in Bitcoin was starting to pick up, especially in the wake of this Slashdot post. More people, including obviously Jed, had cottoned on to Bitcoin, so they were trying to get their hands on some. He was basically in the right place at the right time. And we also had more people mining it as well after the Slashdot post. So it was picking up. Bitcoin was picking up momentum, picking up steam.
So this was a great way for people mining it to earn a bit of money rather than just sitting on it. And a great way for people who wanted to get involved to purchase some without having to go to the trouble of figuring out how to mine it.
Exactly. Exactly. You didn't need to be a techie person in order to try and actually buy some. So this was a big step forward. It was and it made the whole thing easier. This also the fact that there were more people mining, it made the difficulty level of mining go up, meaning that bitcoins became harder to get hold of. So this exchange was really well timed. And as we've seen before, of course, Bitcoin pizza guy Laszlo Hanyecz had figured out how to mine it with his GPU rather than his CPU. So the bar for mining was raised again. So there really was a pretty dire need for a site for those.
Did he have quite a lot of influence on the price of it?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's the way these exchanges work is that, it's what the
demand is. But yeah. Surely you can, if you are the big exchange and you've got, okay, cool. Well, this is what it's costing now.
I guess
the early stages, you'd be able to influence the market quite significantly.
I guess so. I'm not quite sure how that would have worked, whether Jed or whoever was running any whatever exchange could go, do you know what, I'm gonna bump the price up, it's gonna be $1.10 here rather than $1.09 or something somewhere else.
I suppose because if you're bumping up there, then you're having to pay for, unless you're sitting on a load, then it's easier.
Yeah. I mean, I think you want to try and track the price, the general price, fairly accurately.
I suppose you're just making your cut on it. So the more people using it, the more money you're making as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure it's particularly in your interest to offer a lower or a higher price.
Mm.
I mean, I suppose a lower price means that you do get more business. Mm. But it's a slippery slope, I think. I think the market kind of decides.
Yeah.
So Mt. Gox, apparently, according to Alice and Bob, these friends I spoke to, Mt. Gox was apparently a big improvement on previous exchanges. There was less downtime because Jed was actually able to automate parts of it. I think beforehand, whoever had been running it was kind of dealing with all aspects of it. So Jed got the tech working better. So it was also quicker. And plus, apparently, it had a much better user interface. It was just generally easier to use, which obviously helped it gain popularity, and it did so very quickly, and it was pretty soon the biggest Bitcoin business going.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, reading about it, it seems this happened almost overnight. It really, really quickly. Now, this became, for Jed, a bit of a problem, because the more successful something gets, the more admin you have to deal with. And I'm sure you've found this in all lines of work you've been involved with. Success does come at a price. More money, more problems.
To quote Biggie.
Yeah, to quote the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. Mm. Yeah, the more money you get, the more hassle life becomes.
Mm.
So, yeah, as I said before, he was living on the beach in Costa Rica. He was wanting to surf. Him and his partner had a new baby. He basically was just trying to get a nice life and had set up this exchange, to fund that. And I think it was beginning to take over his life a bit. There was just constantly issues to deal with. And there were also security issues as well, because the site, as you can imagine, was becoming a magnet for hackers. And it had quite a few Bitcoin got stolen. And I think with a business like this, cryptocurrency exchanges today spend millions upon millions of dollars on security. It's probably, I think, their biggest outgoing, really. Because, yeah, you've got these huge, they are the places to try and hack. It's like a great big bank vault, in a way. If you can get inside, then you can help yourself. And I mean, I must say, I know nothing about programming at all, nothing about writing code or what it must be to try and keep a website, whatever it's doing, safe from attack and all that sort of stuff. But I can only imagine it's really time consuming and really stressful, especially as more people are trying to hack. And of course, remember, he's holding other people's money. So the responsibility is going up and up. So Jed, as you can imagine, this whole thing was causing him a lot of anxiety, and what he really wanted to do was offload the exchange onto someone else. He'd tried it, he'd got it, it had been successful, and now it was just too much of a hassle. So, at this point in the story, another character enters, and this guy is something else. This is a guy called Mark Karpeles. Mark Karpeles is a fascinating character, and he has got to be one of the most controversial figures in the whole story of Bitcoin up to now. And that's...
Is he alive still?
He is alive.
Okay.
Yeah, he is alive.
For much longer?
Well, I think so.
Okay, so it's not that.
Well, I would hope so. I don't think you can wish any... You wouldn't want to wish any harm on the chap, although I'm sure there are people that do, as we'll find out. So at the time, Mark Karpeles was a 24-year-old French computer programmer. Another one of those. this story is stuffed with... God,
he was into Magic the Gathering. But also surfed.
I don't think he
what
surfed.
What is about surfing? Like, they all seem to surf if they're vaguely
Yes,
taught.
That's right. Hal Finney surfed, didn't he? Yeah, and Jed McCaleb. I don't think the others did, as far as I know.
Just surfed the internet.
they just surfed. Yeah, exactly. No, I don't think Mark Karpeles surfed.
Not in France.
Not in France. And not in Japan, which is where he was living. So, yes, Mark was this 24-year-old computer programmer, and he'd been living in Japan for about a year when he met Jed online. And yeah, he had this thing for Japanese culture. He'd gone over there and just sort of fallen in love with Japan. He loved it. Mm. So he up sticks and moved there. Now, before we say anything else about Mark, he's clearly a very smart guy. He understood Bitcoin as soon as he discovered it. He saw its potential. He got it. And he started, he liked it so much. He had a business. It was a web hosting business, I think it was. And he pretty quickly started accepting it as a form of payment. So he had the vision. He understood it. But he was very socially awkward. One of these guys who's basically happiest sat at a computer. There are suggestions that he maybe suffers from Asperger's syndrome or something like that. He's certainly the sort of person who finds human contact a bit of a struggle.
Mm.
And watching documentaries and stuff about him, people described him as kind of strange and not like most people. This is former colleagues speaking. So not a people person, which is not all that surprising for a computer programmer.
No.
Computer programming is not really a people business, you could argue. Nevertheless, a fascinating character. He was very overweight, obsessed with Japanese culture, and also cats.
Wow, this is ticking a lot of boxes.
Yeah. He owned this web hosting business in Japan. It was called Tiban Limited. And it was named after his cat. Mark and Jed met online. Mark gave Jed a hand with some Mt. Gox-related stuff. He lent him his expertise. And this planted a seed in Jed's mind. So Jed and Mark became quite close, and kind of Jed relied on him a bit. Mt. Gox became more and more of a pain to run. So Jed decided to offer the site to Mark, basically take it off his hands, on very favourable terms. And again, this perhaps should have been a red flag. So basically, Mark was offered 88% of the company in exchange for 50% of the company's revenues for 6 months. Now, when you consider that this is the biggest Bitcoin business going, that pretty much the only place that most people are using to buy Bitcoins, that is a heck of a good offer.
Yeah.
And it's, as I say, probably the sort of deal that should have set alarm bells ringing. What we're going to find out very quickly is that Mark isn't really much of a businessman. So it's perhaps not surprising that didn't show up on his radar. Anyhow, the deal was apparently set up. There were no lawyers involved. It was all pretty amateur. I think they basically drew up their own contracts and sent them to each other to sign, and that was it. Mt. Gox wasn't making all that much money. I mean, it was popular. It was gaining traction, but the cut of each transaction that it was taking as a fee, I should say, it wasn't huge, so we're not talking making money hand over fist, but it was certainly gaining in popularity. However, by the time Mark assumed control of Mt. Gox, he moved its HQ to Tokyo, which is where he was based. This had begun to change, so Mt. Gox was starting to get more and more popular around the time that Mark took it over. And there was a reason for this. And this reason was the emergence of another business that relied on Bitcoin to make its money. Should we take a break? Should we leave them hanging?
Yeah.
This is Neil Strauss,
host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this nine-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Welcome back, everyone, to part two of our third episode about Bitcoin. It's time to talk about the second notorious Bitcoin business that sprung up around this time in 2011.
Yeah.
Okay, let's lead into it a bit. So if Bitcoin was ever going to catch on properly, it was there was going to have to be a real world use case for it. There was going to be have to be something you could buy. You'd need to be able to buy something with it to use it. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I mean, it depends who you ask on this one, such a use case appeared around this time, and its name was the Silk Road.
Silk Road, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's probably fair to assume that most people have heard of this in some...
Well, the first one.
Not the original
Silk Road. The original
Silk Road. Yeah. So the original Silk Road, yes, that was the trading routes from China, wasn't it?
Mm.
This obviously took its inspiration from that, but is very, very different. The best way to describe Silk Road is as an eBay for illegal stuff.
Yeah, and leave feedback.
And leave feedback. Yeah, that was a big part of how it functioned. We'll get to that. So, yeah, it was basically a darknet marketplace. Now, the darknet, we don't want to go too deep into this, but the darknet is kind of a sublayer of the internet that you can only access through a special browser called Tor. And that makes you completely anonymous. So you can interact with these darknet websites and nobody can track you. You don't leave any sort of footprint. The darknet is a fascinating subject. It's huge, apparently.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive. Mm. And all sorts of crazy, illegal, edgy stuff going on there. So Silk Road was a darknet marketplace where users were able to buy mostly illegal drugs. It did also offer other stuff.
Yeah.
So
weapons.
You could get weapons, guns.
Stolen credit card details.
Yeah. You could also get forged passports and other ID documents. You could get hacking tutorials.
Yep.
All that sort of stuff. Hitmen as well.
Yep.
Apparently.
Yep.
Yeah. Although you could buy all sorts of stuff there, drugs made up the vast majority of its business.
Yes.
And, I mean, we've got up here, and I'll leave a link to this in the show notes, but we've got here a picture of Silk Road's kind of landing page, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So up in the top left corner, there's the logo, which is a man on a camel, all in green. And it says Silk Road Anonymous Market. And then you've got a little menu down the side, and you've got drugs as a heading, and then you've got all these subheadings. Let's have a look. Cannabis, disassociatives, ecstasy, opioids, other.
Mm.
I wonder what other is. Precursors, prescription, stimulants, psychedelics, all this sort of stuff. And then you've got other headings. Apparel, art, what's that? Biotic materials, books, all sorts of stuff. Now, what was really important about Silk Road was if you're buying or selling drugs or anything else illegal over the internet, even on the dark web, you don't want to use your real identity and you don't want to pay using a bank account or credit card or PayPal account or whatever it is that's in your name.
No.
You don't need to be an expert on privacy or internet security to know that. So the person who created the Silk Road, who we'll talk about later, they realized that Bitcoin was the form of payment to use. And yeah, anonymity was absolutely key for Silk Road. And it should be pointed out here that Bitcoin is not actually wholly anonymous. I think we may have touched on this before.
Yeah.
It's pseudonymous. So if the authorities really want to trace you through Bitcoin, they can. And nowadays, they're a lot better at it. But it wasn't completely anonymous back then. So, but it was... It was certainly a much better option than using
cash.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't really use cash, could you?
No. Digicash.
Yeah. It was a lot better option than using traditional ways of buying things on the internet. The advantages here are clear. Bitcoin could be sent peer to peer, buyer to seller, without anyone in between to stop it from happening, and there was relative privacy on it. And so Silk Road made use of this kind of nexus of new emerging technology. It had the darknet, and it had Bitcoin, and it couldn't have functioned without both.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a very clever invention. So yeah, Silk Road, it took advantage of this kind of meeting of two new
needs.
Technologies. Yeah, this meeting of the darknet and everything that it allowed you to do, and also Bitcoin. And it was, you can see the advantages, I think. Whatever your stance on drugs is, and obviously it was set up with fairly sort of libertarian ideals around drugs. So the advantages of Silk Road, I think, are pretty clear. Regardless of your stance on drugs in general and drug laws, it's much better to buy your drugs if you're going to buy them. It's much better to buy them from the comfort of your own home and have them sent to you in the mail.
Yeah, rather than meeting a dodgy man down a dodgy alley to buy some dodgy substance.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a much better option. And, of course, much better for both sides of the bargain, much better for the buyer and much better for the seller, because they didn't have to go out and pound the streets and risk arrest and all that sort of stuff. They could mail things out from the comfort of their own home as well. And as you touched on, yeah, it had a review system, so they couldn't be 100% sure that what they were getting was what they were paying for. But yeah, it sort of built up trust in that if a dealer had lots of bad reviews, then you just wouldn't use them.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to how eBay works, or especially more eBay than Amazon, because, you know, it was more focus on the review was down to, okay, cool, discreet packaging, timely comms, all of this sort of stuff, which is more important than when you're buying a substantial amount of drugs than when you're buying, you know, some replacement batteries for your remote or something like that. So these are the things that were important to people. The type of packaging that it came in, air sealed, all of this sort of stuff, so that those pesky authorities wouldn't catch on.
Yeah, yeah. And it's fascinating reading about it, actually, because the US authorities, as we'll see, they began, and authorities everywhere, began to become much more aware of what was going on. And yeah, they started sort of trying to intercept these drug packages and stuff. And, you know, they turned out, and they were really baffled at the start, because they would occasionally, you know, the sniffer dogs would occasionally come through the mail depot at various US airports or something, and they'd sniff something out, and they'd find that they kept finding lots of individual packages of maybe one or two ecstasy pills or something like that, or a small packet of cocaine or something, which they'd never really seen before. And it took them a while to realize what was going on. But as you can imagine, when they did, it was fairly alarming, because this was an entirely new way of doing things. So Silk Road was set up by another entrepreneurial figure, very different from Jed McCaleb, who later adopted the handle of Dread Pirate Roberts. Do you remember the movie?
Is that Captain? No. No, I don't. Pirates of the Caribbean.
No, the Princess Bride.
Princess Bride.
Yeah, it's that quite weird, quirky kind of kids movie from the 80s.
Oh, no, I'm out.
Okay, and the Dread Pirate Roberts from the Princess Bride, he was this mysterious figure. And the thing with it was that the mantle of the Dread Pirate Roberts sort of passed from one person to the next.
Oh.
So it sort of seemed as though he was immortal.
But
actually, it was just one, you know, when one Dread Pirate Roberts got fed up and wanted to retire from being a Dread Pirate, he would pass it on to the next person, who would just assume the mantle and carry on. So the myth sort of perpetuated itself. Anyway, Silk Road appeared in February 2011, and a bit like Mt. Gox, took off pretty quickly.
Yes.
And here's a fascinating quote from Mark Karpeles, again, the guy who was running Mt. Gox by this point. And this is from a 2018 interview. And he says, as far as I know, a third to half of transactions on Mt. Gox were linked to Silk Road.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of transactions.
Yeah.
But I suppose that's kind of, you know, one early adopters of most things on the internet is normally not stuff that's too above board.
Yes.
You know, porn is a pioneer of most technologies, and poison drugs is a pioneer of this technology.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary statistic, that, isn't it? All this Bitcoin was taking off, becoming more popular, but really people were using it to buy drugs.
Yes.
And other naughty stuff. And bear in mind, of course, that by July 2011, so just a few months after Silk Road launched, 80% of Bitcoin trading was being done through Mt. Gox.
Yeah.
So, yeah, basically at this time, Bitcoin was being used mostly to buy illegal stuff. And because there weren't any other use cases, there weren't many other businesses accepting it for any other products or services. So it was all about drugs. And this is something that Bitcoin, I think, has, it's still kind of trying to shake that image, I think, in a lot of people's
minds. You talk about the 80s. Mm. I'm sure dollar was used, a large chunk of dollar was used to buy drugs.
Absolutely.
Doesn't mean that it's a... We should get rid of the dollar.
Well, quite, yeah. And this is an argument that comes up a lot when people talk about, oh, we should get rid of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency because it facilitates money laundering or it facilitates people buying drugs and doing illegal stuff. It's like, well, what did you think they were using before? Mm. You ban cash? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But as you can imagine, these businesses were attracting, both Mt. Gox and Silk Road were attracting a lot of press attention. And of course, the price of Bitcoin started to go up as well. Now, shall we take a quick break before we talk about how it all went wrong?
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode. and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good, because every year dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them, but with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We have this situation where we've got these two Bitcoin-focused businesses, Mt. Gox, the exchange, and Silk Road, the drugs
exchange
supermarket. Both of these businesses are picking up loads of traction. Mt. Gox is by far the biggest Bitcoin exchange, and Silk Road is where most of the Bitcoin is being spent. And so, as we've hinted at, let's go back to Mt. Gox firstly. Let's talk about how it all started to unravel at Mt. Gox. As I've mentioned, Mark Karpeles wasn't really all that suited to running a business like Mt. Gox.
No.
He wasn't a people person, as I've said. And here's from that same 2018 interview I quoted earlier. He says, humans are much harder to manage than servers, which gives you an idea of, He was bad at interacting with staff. He really was the wrong man in the wrong job, and this would have catastrophic consequences. When Jed McCaleb had sold Mt. Gox to Mark, there had already been some security issues. Now, this is to mitigate Mark a little bit. This is to cut him a little bit of slack. There were security issues early on with all these instances of hacking, various breaches, and when it appears that thousands of bitcoins were missing from the exchange when Mark took it over in March of 2011. Okay, this has come to light in subsequent years. Now, these weren't really worth much at the time. Thousands of Bitcoin sounds like a lot, but as the price of BTC wasn't really that high at the time, it was a few thousand dollars. So it wasn't ideal, but it wasn't
catastrophic.
Yeah. But as the price of Bitcoin started to go up, these missing bitcoins, this shortfall became more of a problem. And now Jed claims that Mark knew about this when he took it on. He said, look, I was completely open about this. I said that these bitcoins had been lost. He knew the risks. He knew what had happened. Mark, perhaps unsurprisingly, claims otherwise. And this is one of those bones of contention that we'll never really know the answer to. But whatever the case, Mt. Gox, after Mark took it over, quickly became notoriously unreliable. And again, speaking to Alice and Bob about this, that was one of the things that they said. Withdrawals became really slow. If you wanted to get your money out, you sometimes had to wait days, weeks, or even months.
Wow.
At that point. Customer service was bad or non-existent, and obviously there were hacks going on all the time. And you can imagine how... I said to both Alice and Bob, this must have been really stressful for you. If you've put money into this exchange and you're trying to get it out, and you're waiting weeks at a time. And they said, well, yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, it's not ideal. And actually, both of them have got emails from Mark Karpeles himself. They showed me some screenshots of them. Mm. And he would often personally respond to these customer queries, which again, for someone who's the kind of CEO, the managing director of this business, you sort of think you shouldn't be handling customer support. You have more important things to do. Mm. And this is just another example of how completely unsuited Mark was to running this exchange, to doing this job. And Mt. Gox, it simply grew too fast. It had about around 3,000 users in March 2011, and 3 months later, it had 60,000 plus.
Jeez.
It's absolutely exponential growth, hockey stick growth, as they say. But security was far too slack, and Mark was simply just slow to hire people to help him with everything that needed to be done. Like I say, he was managing things like customer support, doing 101 other different jobs, which he should have just delegated. You'd have been.
So this is the fire festival of crypto exchanges.
Yes.
Good promising analogy. A lot, delivering very little.
Yeah.
Is someone going to jail?
Yeah. Not to give too much away.
Okay.
People are going to jail.
Okay.
Yes, Mark was not good at prioritizing, or just wasn't very professional a lot of the time. And there's an extraordinary story from 2011. There'd been a big security breach at Mt. Gox. I mean, this happened quite a lot, but there was a particularly serious one. And two Americans, a guy called Roger Ver, who has since become known as Bitcoin Jesus. He was a real early Bitcoin evangelist. I think he got the name because he would give away Bitcoin in order to try, you know, to teach people about it. I'm sure we'll talk about him at another point in another episode. So Roger Ver and his friend Jesse Powell, who now runs the Kraken cryptocurrency exchange, he's an interesting chap as well. But they heard there'd been a breach. Roger was actually living in Tokyo at the time, very near where Mt. Gox was headquartered. So Roger got in touch with Mark and said, look, let me help. Let me come and help. So they turned up, Jesse turned up a few days later, to basically help sort the mess out. And they started, they weren't really coders, but they kind of dug into the customer support stuff and, you know, basically gave their time and effort, you know, to try and help sort this situation out. And there was a real backlog of work. And then one Friday evening, as they were sort of packing up to go, and they said to Mark, should we see you tomorrow? What time? Mark was like, tomorrow's the weekend. Can't possibly. And they were like, yes,
yeah.
But
there's quite a lot.
Yeah, and this was just him. And I mean, I recommend you, if you watch a video, if you watch Mark Carpelli's on video, you can sort of see he's got a very low energy vibe. He's very sort of slow and kind of stolid, and he seems almost laid back to the point of lying down. So. Again, it can't be stressed enough just how unsuited he was.
Had he just read like the 4-hour work week or something like
that? I think so. Yeah, he just couldn't prioritize. He just couldn't run this bloody business. Not everything, I should say, was his fault, though. As Bitcoin became more visible and Silk Road started causing all this negative publicity, it basically became harder and harder for Mt. Gox to access banking services. Now, this is nothing to do with Mark, and there was only so much that he was able to do. And obviously, if you're running a cryptocurrency exchange where people are looking to buy Bitcoin with cash, with fiat money, you've got to have some sort of banking relationship, because otherwise there's no other way of getting money to the exchange. And yeah, so these banks were getting increasingly nervous about Bitcoin, and they sort of started cutting off their services to Mt. Gox, which, as you can imagine, made things very, very difficult. Now, there was so much going wrong at Mt. Gox, there isn't time to go into all the details here, but the major issue, we believe, began actually in late 2011 when a hacker began draining Bitcoin out of the exchange's hot wallet. Have you heard that phrase before, hot wallet?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard of a cold wallet.
Okay. Well, a hot wallet basically is a crypto wallet that's connected to the internet. And all exchanges have hot wallets because they need to have cryptocurrency on hand for daily trading purposes. So every crypto exchange will keep a certain amount of crypto in a hot wallet connected to the internet so people can buy and sell it and trade it and what have you. However, for safety's sake, it is best to store funds in a cold wallet. Now, a cold wallet, as you might have guessed, is...
not connected to the internet.
Exactly, exactly. It can take many forms. It can be a sort of hardware device, a bit like a flash drive, which we call a hardware wallet. You can even have paper wallets where basically the private keys are written down or printed out on a piece of paper, and that's held in a secure location, a secure place, so no one can hack it. But basically, the Mt. Gox hot wallet, Mt. Gox did keep an amount of Bitcoin in cold storage offline, but what they didn't notice was that someone had started to drain the hot wallet. Okay, so this is something to remember.
Just slowly, slowly.
Yeah. Exactly. Over the course of several years, the hacker was able to slowly drain coins out of Mt. Gox's hot wallet, and they just never picked up on it. And this is, again, you can sort of slightly lay the blame at Mark's door here, because this is something that they should have become aware of, but they weren't. Anyhow, things basically came to a head in February 2014. By this point, users had been very wary of Mt. Gox for a long time. Its reputation was really pretty bad. And it was so bad, in fact, that the price of Bitcoin was $100 higher on Mt. Gox than on any other exchanges.
What?
Its reputation had gotten so bad that it was more expensive to buy Bitcoin there. People were just becoming less and less willing to use it.
Mm.
That said, there was still a lot of volume going through it. But people realized that this came at a price, and people were very wary of it indeed. As I've said before, it was notoriously difficult to get your fiat deposits out of Mt. Gox, and really the only way to get funds out in any sort of timely manner was to...
transfer your Bitcoin to somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what a lot of people did. But again, talking to Alice and Bob as well, they'd recognized this for a while. But towards the end, even withdrawing Bitcoin became difficult. So February the 7th, 2014, Mt. Gox suspended all withdrawals. No one really knew why. And Mark did something very naughty at this point. He blamed the problem on the Bitcoin code itself.
Sacrilege.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A really bad thing to do. Now, there was an issue known as transaction malleability. And I'm going to read Mark's a press release that Mark put out at the time in order to explain what we mean by transaction malleability. So he said in the Mt. Gox press release, a bug in the Bitcoin software makes it possible for someone to use the Bitcoin network to alter transaction details to make it seem like a sending of Bitcoins to a Bitcoin wallet did not occur, when in fact it did occur. Since the transaction appears as if it has not proceeded correctly, the Bitcoins may be resent. Mt. Gox is working with the Bitcoin Core development team and others to mitigate this issue. Now, does that all make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I sort of looked for ways to explain this transaction malleability thing, but I think that
was it an actual issue?
It was an issue, yeah. It was something that others had noticed with the Bitcoin code. But, yeah, it was known about and it was pretty easily dealt with. And all the other exchanges had developed a way to work around it. So it was an issue, but it wasn't a big issue. And it was something that was known about. And, again, Mt. Gox should have known about it. Mark should have known about it. So not only was he blaming Bitcoin itself for a problem that he should have known about and mitigated much earlier, but he was the press release itself tanked the price of Bitcoin, because regular users who didn't know about this little quirk in the Bitcoin code believed that Bitcoin itself was broken. Now, if this had been true, that would have been a major issue. I mean, that could have been
the end of the project.
Yeah, terminal for Bitcoin. So... yeah, Mark did a really bad thing here. And lots of other, I think Gavin Andreessen, among others, sort of jumped on this and were like, no, 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 no. This isn't a problem with Bitcoin. It's a problem with Mt. Gox. You know, you need to fix it. And unfortunately, as February 2014 wore on, things only got worse. You got to the point where you had angry customers protesting outside the Mt. Gox HQ in Tokyo with signs saying, like, Mt. Gox, where is our money? Which is never a good sign when people start turning up at the office. The 23rd of February, the company Twitter went offline. Again, not a good sign. The following day on the 24th, trading was suspended and the website went offline. By this point, there were rumours of missing bitcoins. And then on the 28th of February, a few days later, Mt. Gox filed for bankruptcy protection. Basically, the game, basically admitting over that the game was up. Now, what it emerged happened was, and hold on to your seat for this, it emerged that Mt. Gox had lost 850,000 bitcoins.
Jeez.
Yeah, worth around $500 million at the time. I mean, worth a heck of a lot more now, but a substantial amount at the time. In fact, it was about 7% of all the Bitcoin in circulation.
Oh,
at that
my
point.
God.
Yeah, it was an absolute disaster. 750,000 of these.
What year was this?
This was February 2014. So most of these belonged to customers that were lost, but the exchange itself lost 100,000 of its own. They were like, we've lost your money. Now imagine a bank saying that. We're terribly sorry.
This can't... really is the Wild West days of Bitcoin, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. This was, I mean, and you can imagine the sort of reaction from, I mean, people within the crypto, the Bitcoin and crypto community, and from without as well. You've lost them. What?
Well, can you find them?
Yeah, I think that was the response from a lot of people.
I mean, because it's all sort of traceable, do we know where a lot of these have gone?
Well, we did. Yeah, we have an idea. I'll get to that in a minute. The story gets even weirder because, as you can imagine, all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
And people's worst fears were confirmed.
Did Mark start working weekends?
I think perhaps he might have done.
Yeah.
I don't know. By this point, I think another weird thing that I read about was around this time, like they knew before they had to announce, you know, before the thing really fell apart in late February, they knew there were problems. And Mark, apparently, rather than focus on the job that he needed to, you know, getting these problems sorted, apparently he was busy setting up like a Bitcoin cafe on the ground floor of the building where it had its offices. Like, that was his priority, a cafe where you could buy everything with Bitcoin. And he was sort of spending hours a day kind of footling around that, you know, trying to get that set up. Meanwhile, a few stories up in the Mt. Gox offices, people are just...
$500 million. People are considering jumping.
Yeah, $500 million are basically missing. Mm. So, again, just utterly, utterly useless for this particular job.
Did the cafe go well, or...?
Funnily enough, no.
Okay.
I don't think it ever...
I'm just wondering. I mean, that could have been... Not everything was a loss. Yeah. It's gone on to become one of the most popular cafes in that part of Japan.
That would be a nice little...
Turning over hundreds of pounds a month.
That would be a nice little...
Yeah.
I
hope it. Not everything went terrible for Mark. You'd hope, you know...
Yeah, he's like, oh, well...
His cupcake business is thriving.
Yes, that would have been a nice little ending to the story if, although Mt. Gox had collapsed, the cafe went from strength to strength, and Mark is still happily
and
there.
And is now Pret-a-Manger.
Yeah, it's now been taken over by Pret-a-Manger, or whatever the Japanese equivalent Manger. Is. There's an added twist to this story.
Mm-hmm.
After these 850,000 bitcoins, 7% of all in circulation, had gone missing,
yeah.
A few days later, the exchange...
They found them.
They had found them.
Are you serious? It was in the till of the cafe.
They were underneath the drawer.
Yeah, it's sometimes they just get stuck behind the thing. It's yeah, you always got to check there.
It's all right. What had actually happened was it announced it had found 200,000 of them, which is obviously a start,
mm.
it still leaves a fairly substantial number outstanding. Gee. But yeah, this was what, you know, and as you can imagine, people are like, okay, so you lost them and now you've found some of them. What the...
Can I have them back?
Yes, what the hell is going on? So...
This must do wonders for your public image.
Yeah, yeah. This had, I mean, this was disastrous for Bitcoin. It was terrible for, yeah, as you can imagine. But basically, the upshot of this story is that a lot of people lost a lot of money.
Mm.
A lot of people lost a lot of money. Many, unfortunately, had their life savings and their kids' college funds and things like that. I mean, there are some pretty tragic stories that don't put your life savings into anything, really, into one single thing. But, you know, these were people who clearly believed in Bitcoin, clearly believed in its potential. And, yeah, I mean, that's the real upshot to this story, is that it had a pretty unhappy ending. So Mark was eventually arrested in August 2015 and charged with embezzlement. So they believed that he had something to do with it. Many people believed that he was somehow responsible, that he'd stolen the Bitcoin or at least been involved in some way. And he was eventually found guilty in March 2019. This went on and on and on. He was found guilty of falsifying data and he was given a 30-month suspended sentence.
What?
Yeah. He was basically, he'd served a lot of prison time by that point. I think the way in Japan is, you know, you're basically kind of held in prison until they find you innocent. And Mark was, yeah, he'd served his time by that point, so he was able to walk free.
Who was running the cafe?
I don't know. The cat, I think. Taban.
Taban.
Yeah. Now a lot of people think that Mark was involved somehow, and I have to say, not only was he found. He was only found guilty of falsifying data. They didn't. The authorities didn't believe that he was responsible at all. And actually, from watching and listening to interviews with him, he just doesn't come across as the sort of person who could do that. So it is fairly unlikely that Mark was involved in any crime. And if you watch interviews with him, if you listen to him talking, you can see that. I think he's not a criminal type. As I've said, he's this very kind of low energy, just, you know, laid back kind of guy. So, yeah, but it was, as you can imagine, it was a terrible time for all involved. I do have, I must say, to be controversial here, I do have a bit of sympathy for Mark because it must have been the most stressful experience.
Yeah, running a cafe is tricky.
I mean, all those people demanding complicated coffees and things like that. And
I want my quiche like this.
Yeah, having to bake those cupcakes.
No, you know what? I've been in situations before where things are going wrong, and it is very easy to just bury your head in something else.
Yeah,
procrastinate. Like mostly for me, it's around exam time when I was at university. And I would never have a tidier room.
Yeah.
Was it revise for this exam or sort out my record collection and sort of make up my room?
Yeah.
And you'd always go, you know what? I haven't vacuumed in a while.
Yeah.
Once I finish this vacuuming, then I'll concentrate on the $500 million that I've got missing. Yeah.
First things first. Yeah.
It's the weekend. I mean, well, I'll pick this up Monday.
It can wait. I'm the same. I can think back. I mean, exams were kind of similar for me, but also I think most of us have been in that sort of situation at some point.
I would also like to say, if my kids' college fund was in that situation, I probably wouldn't be quite so empathetic.
Yes, I think that's fair enough.
You know, I empathize because I've got no skin in the game and I've been in situations in my life, not quite to this extent, where, you know, you've got something pressing or you've messed up and it's like, okay, I'll just divert my interest into something else to sort of not think about it.
It's difficult to empathize, perhaps, but, you know, you can...
No, I can empathize, but I also can empathize with the people who are the real victims here.
Yeah, that's true. But I can imagine that sort of situation, can't you? Like, this is, I could go and have a nice time just sort of getting my little cafe sorted, or I could go and address this black hole into which people's money is disappearing. I can't forgive it, but I can understand it in a way. I think it just must have all got on top
of it. Yeah, it just becomes overwhelming.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's hard. I doubt everyone can have sympathy for Mark. But
and do you think the Costa Rican guys saw this coming? Was just like, I am out of this.
Jed McCaleb.
Yeah.
I don't think he can have seen this catastrophe coming.
No.
But I think, yeah, I mean, I think he was experiencing that stress and he took the opportunity to go, do you know what? I don't need this. I don't need this. I'm going to pass it on. Funnily enough, Jed McCaleb has gone on to other things. He went on to co-found Ripple.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which Ripple is having its own sort of legal problems at the moment
with
the Securities and Exchange Commission. Okay, well, good luck with that. And he actually left Ripple and went on to found Stellar, which is a kind of rival to Ripple. So he's bounced between a lot of projects in his
time. My mate made a lot of money on that.
On Stellar?
Stellar Lumen, yeah.
Mm. Oh, good for him.
Yeah, I wish I had.
So just as a little coda to the whole Mt. Gox story, a Russian man named Alexander Vinnik is believed to be largely responsible.
Okay.
Yeah. So he ran a rival crypto exchange called BTCE, which is thought to have received at least some of the stolen Mt. Gox bitcoins. Now, to briefly talk about Alexander Vinnik, he is basically, I think the technical term is, an all-round baddie. A massive bad guy.
An 80s bad guy.
Yeah.
They were Russian back in the 80s, weren't they?
They were Russian, and Alexander Vinnik himself is Russian.
Yeah.
So, yeah. He's currently serving 5 years in France for money laundering. He's also thought to be involved in hacking, ransomware, identity theft, and drug trafficking. The whole enchilada.
Yeah.
He's a bad guy. The Russian and American authorities are waiting to have their chunk of him as well. So I think he's staring down the barrel of maybe the rest of his life in prison.
Oh, jeez.
I think there were almost certainly others involved with Vinnik, but he seems to have been the focus taken most of the form. So Mt. Gox's creditors may eventually get compensated, which is a bit of good news. In the last thing that happened really was in October 2021, a compensation plan was agreed. As we record this, no payouts have yet been made, but it looks like the Mt. Gox saga may be kind of drawing to its close, and these guys may get some, maybe all their bitcoins back. But
actual bitcoins in the same what they're worth today?
Well, yeah, I mean, because they'll be getting if they get the number of bitcoins that they lost, then yeah, they'll be able to sell them at today's prices. I'm not quite sure how it's all been worked out, whether it's
that would be quite, you know, forced hodling.
Yeah. Yeah. They could end up being grateful for it, I guess. Mm. But yeah, I mean,
you can buy the college now. You don't have
So just to round off with Mt. Gox, it was obviously terrible PR for Bitcoin. It still casts a shadow over it, I think. I think a lot of people's perception of Bitcoin and obviously their experiences with it are coloured by what happened with Mt. Gox. Many people mistakenly saw the whole Mt. Gox thing as a weakness of Bitcoin. Now, this is not the case. Bitcoin itself has never been hacked. And it was no flaw of Bitcoin. What it did show, the whole thing, was the danger of trusting centralized entities, which ironically
was the point of Bitcoin.
Yeah. So in a weird way, in a weird and horrible and traumatizing way, Mt. Gox kind of made Bitcoin's point. It's about taking ownership of your own assets. Do not trust the middlemen.
How can people find out what exchanges are the most reputable?
We do have quite a few videos on our YouTube channel where we talk about various exchanges and we compare them and things like that. I mean, yeah, that's a good question, because there are still dodgy exchanges out there. Some of them are dodgy because the people running them are dodgy and badly intentioned. Others are dodgy because their security is lax. Yeah. Basically, if an exchange has very low trading volumes or suspicious amounts, you know, suspicious trading volumes or risk or lists a lot of very dodgy altcoins and things like that, then you need to be careful. But yeah, you can quite easily Google the sort of top tier exchanges, things like Binance, FTX, Coinbase, KuCoin, things like this. You know, they're well run, they're regulated exchanges. And they've got very, very strong security. But exchange hacks were something that have almost every exchange out there has been hacked at some point. But yeah, the Mt. Gox was by far.
Is
by
there
far
a
the worst.
Qantas airline? Do you know how? Do you remember the film Rain Man? And he would only get onto Qantas because the only airline that has never crashed. Is there an exchange like that so that they've never been hacked or crashed even?
Is there an exchange that's never been hacked? As far as I know, I mean, I think there's a slightly newer exchange called FTX, which has only been going a couple of years. As far as I know, that hasn't suffered any breaches. But it, I mean, Coinbase in its early days had problems. Binance has had problems. They're the two biggest in the world at the moment. And yeah, I mean, but exchanges have lots of security procedures in place now. And they also have insurance and compensation schemes and stuff. So they're a heck of a lot safer than they were. But I mean, this is, you know, the lessons of Mt. Gox, I think, have been learned. But yeah, the exchanges are still tricky, because keeping your coins on an exchange, it's centralized. It's keeping them in one place, and it does make them more vulnerable. So we've talked about the collapse of Mt. Gox. Let's quickly round up this episode by talking about the end of the Silk Road. Just as Mt. Gox came crashing down, so too did Silk Road, though in slightly different circumstances. So they'd obviously, like Mt. Gox, Silk Road had become a runaway success, attracted obviously lots of attention, both from press and the authorities and from hackers and other ne'er-do-wells. Mainstream attention came to it in June 2011 through an article in Gawker, which I think is now defunct.
Thanks to Hulk Hogan
and Peter Thiel.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a strange story. Anyhow, the mastermind behind the Silk Road turned out to be one Ross Ulbricht, who was from Austin, Texas, young guy from Austin, Texas. He had strong libertarian views, which he honed when he was in college. So again, the libertarianism just features so many times in the Bitcoin story. He believed in low state intervention. He believed that people should make their own choices when it came to things like drugs. So after graduating from Penn State in 2009, he had a master's in science and engineering. He was kind of at a bit of a loss with what to do with his life, and he was very idealistic. He wanted to have an impact on the world. So these kind of views, these combined with his kind of libertarian views, inspired him to set up Silk Road. So Ross had some coding skills. He wasn't a professional coder by any means. He had to get others to help him out as the site got bigger. But I think the code that he originally built for Silk Road was kind of full of holes and stuff. So he was sort of constantly having to patch it and fight fires and things. But Silk Road picked up traction very quickly, like Mt. Gox did. It had nearly 1 million user accounts by the time it was shut down. Now, a lot of users would have had multiple accounts, but the authorities reckon it had hundreds of thousands of unique users. Yeah. And by some estimates, it did close to $1 billion in sales over its lifetime, which obviously earned Ross Ulbricht a lot of money. But he wasn't a really very material person. He was happy just living out of a rucksack. And he kind of traveled around the States and Australia and Southeast Asia, and he would just run Silk Road from his laptop, which was obviously heavily encrypted. But as with Mark running Mt. Gox, as Mark Karpeles found, as Jed McCaleb before him found, running this sort of site became a massive pain in the backside. And he was constantly having to attend to issues, to repel these hacking attempts, dealing with complaints again, but had the kind of added pressure of he had to do it without getting caught.
Yeah, it's not just, okay, cool, where's my money from, Bill in Arkansas. It's where's my money from Jose in Juarez?
Jose with lots of guns.
Yeah.
And obviously dealing with some pretty shady...
And also avoiding the authorities as well.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And again, as Mark Karpeles must have found, it must have been so stressful, you know, that not only trying to run this business, but also knowing that if you got caught,
it's not a 30-month suspended sentence.
No, not by any means, as we'll see. So all the while, agents from U.S. law enforcement were on his tail. It was picking up a lot of traction. And as it went on, you know, I think the Department of Homeland Security got involved.
I saw a Netflix documentary on this. Actually.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And there's a great book called American Kingpin by a guy called Nick Bilton, which tells the whole story in detail. Very, very readable. I do recommend that. I'll leave a link to that in the show notes. I think the DEA, the FBI, Homeland Security, all the three-letter agencies were getting involved as it went along. And they managed to infiltrate the site's forums, and some DEA agents managed to establish contact with Ross, who was still using this Dread Pirate Roberts, or DPR, pseudonym. Now, to cut a long story short, Ross was eventually tracked down to San Francisco and dramatically arrested in a public library there. This was 30th of September 2013. And the way they tracked him down was very, very clever. They managed to dig up old usernames that he'd used,
which
they could then link back to his email address that had his actual name in. But it was a very painstaking process, and they were on his tail for a long time. But yeah, they tracked him down, and when they arrested him, they had to make sure that they got him with his laptop open, because they knew that, I think they tried to arrest some other hacker a few years previously. I think the FBI had tried to seize this computer hacker, and he'd managed to close his laptop just before he was arrested, which automatically encrypted everything. And it took them a lot of... It was really... I think they managed to crack his password in the end. But yeah, so that it was vital that they got him without him being able to close his laptop and encrypt it. So I think they staged a distraction. I think two FBI agents pretended to be like lovers having a quarrel or something like that, shouting at each other. And he was distracted. And when he was distracted, like, others moved in and grabbed him. And one of them grabbed his laptop and stuck a flash drive in to copy it. It was all very, very dramatic Hollywood stuff. And Ross was charged with money laundering. He was charged with conspiracy to commit computer hacking and conspiracy to traffic narcotics. A pretty long rap sheet. Now, the prosecution also presented evidence that he tried to have several people killed.
Yes.
Because they had threatened to expose him. And weird, I'm not quite sure why they didn't present that evidence exactly, but as the pressure of the site had gotten worse, he was obviously being blackmailed and extorted and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, there is evidence to suggest that he tried to have certain people bumped off. I think he tried to get the Hell's Angels involved at one point. And the FBI or the DEA, one of the two, actually staged the torture and execution of one guy who had been an administrator on Silk Road. They managed to turn him. They managed to catch him in the act. They managed to turn him, and they sort of videoed themselves supposedly torturing him and took videos of his pictures of his supposedly dead body and sent them to Ross saying, you know, job done. Now give us the rest of our money. It was all pretty shady, but it turned out that nobody was actually killed. So evidence was submitted for these attempted assassinations, but Ross wasn't charged. However, when he was found guilty of the other charges, sentenced at the end of May 2015 to...
Quite a sentence.
Yes. Double life imprisonment plus 40 years.
I mean, look, that seems... I know he's facilitating a lot more transactions of drugs, but is that... I don't know. It seems they were making an example, really, weren't
absolutely,
they?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I think Ross Ulbricht's sentence is unnecessarily harsh.
Yeah.
The evidence for the attempted killings was apparently a factor in the judge's decision. And law enforcement also subsequently managed to secure convictions against dozens of dealers who'd used the site as well. So it did all come crashing down. And Ross's arrest and conviction, they did cause the price of Bitcoin to dip, but only temporarily. So Bitcoin, kind of weathered this storm as well. Mm. So let's bring this all to a close. I'd love to have talked about especially Silk Road more, because it's such a fascinating experiment, really.
Yeah.
But there really isn't time today. So I do urge people to read that Nick Bilton book. And as you say, there are various documentaries about it as well.
Yeah, for those who don't read.
Yeah.
Which may be quite a few of you, seeing as you're listening to this. there's some great videos to watch.
Yeah.
Coin Bureau has a few.
Yes, I think we have talked about Silk Road before, but there are lots of sort of specialist documentaries. I think there's even a feature film. Yeah, so you can dive into the Silk Road story a lot deeper, both books, films, or podcasts. I'm sure. So let's bring this all to a conclusion then. So it's fair to say Mt. Gox and Silk Road both played huge roles in bringing Bitcoin into wider public consciousness, but both also contributed to the perception that it was a scam or, incredibly risky or only used by criminals. And like I've said before, I think a lot of people still hold these views today. So it's an image. They both caused image problems that Bitcoin is still trying to shake to an extent with some people. I think most of the world has moved on.
I think now that there's big hedge funds and stuff getting involved in it, it's...
Yeah. So what's important to remember, though, is that whatever the perception of Bitcoin in the wake of these cases, what's important to remember is that Bitcoin itself was never hacked or compromised.
No,
it was these other exchanges, this exchange and this drugs marketplace, and I don't think you can pin the rap on Bitcoin for what people chose to do with it. Certainly, in the case of Silk Road. So, it was these centralized services that used it. They were the weak points in Bitcoin. Bitcoin lived on. So, next episode, we've covered Bitcoin in quite a lot of depth over these last three episodes. I think we'll do one more episode on Bitcoin next time, and we're just going to bring it up to the present day, because there's so much to the Bitcoin story, and we could talk for hours, we could talk for days about all the ins and outs of it. But I think probably it's...
Nice synopsis of it, bring it up to speed, and then crack on with maybe a different coin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's lots more coins, there's lots more projects, there's so much more to talk about crypto. So, but I think, by the end of the next episode, we'll be sort of... Bitcoin will be with us in the present day. We'll have had a good general overview of its history. And I hope everyone will understand it better, understand where it came from, what it's trying to do, where it's gone, and the people, crucially, I think the people involved with it. Because, again, as we've seen today with Mark Karpeles and Ross Ulbricht and people like that, there are just so many fascinating people, even if some of them
are a bit more...
A little
unscrupulous.
Yes, let's say that. Let's leave it at that. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah.
See you next time, folks.
I'll see you next week, guys.
See you next week. Thank you so much for listening to the Coin Bureau podcast. If you'd like to learn more about cryptocurrency, you can visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Coin Bureau. You can also go to coinbureau.com for loads more information about all things crypto. You can follow me on Twitter at Coin Bureau, all one word. And I'm also active on TikTok and Instagram as well.
First of all, it's not thank you for listening. You're welcome for great content. Yeah? Like, this is free. And they're learning about a fairly great topic in a non-boring way. If you'd like to visit me and hear more about me, go to Moochabout, MOOCHABOUT, or else.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.